12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Välkomna till MSDN Radio för vecka 18 och vecka 19 tror jag ska kolla.
Nej. Det är vecka 2021. Det är 21 nu.
21 eller 22. Oj, 21, det är slut på maj.
Ja, jag visst.
Ja. Men varför gjorde vi en countdown?
Vi har ju precis släppt beta 1.
Är det någonting jag har längtat efter? Jag måste säga att jag har faktiskt längtat mer efter beta 1 än till och med Windows 7.
Ja, jag håller med. Alltså, vi har ju haft betakoden tillgänglig internt ett tag. Men alltså, vi har inte kunnat visa den och vi har inte kunnat göra någonting speciellt mer än annat. Och den har ju varit...
buggig.
Ja, den har varit lite buggig. Men och också någonting som vi har velat kört virtuellt. Eftersom vi visste att när betan kommer så vill vi installera lokalt. Så man kan verkligen köra och fullt ut. Och det ser ju bra ut.
Så enligt planerna, så när ni hör den här så har den släppts på MSDN, så ni som har ett MSDN-konto kan logga in och ladda ner alltihopa. Och för er som inte har det så kan ni vänta en eller två dagar så kommer det att komma ut på den offentliga MSDN-sajten. Så lycka till och grabba tag i det här nu och börja riktigt fördjupa er i, ja, hur mycket nyheter ska jag säga. Jag kunde inte låta bli att installera det här, så att jag har ju kört över helgen då, precis som du.
Absolut.
Ja, vad var det första du körde?
Det första jag körde, det här kommer låta jättenördigt, eller hur?
XNA.
Nej, det första jag provade det var Entity Framework version 2s nya designverktyg.
Ja, men det gjorde jag med. Men du, nu måste jag fråga, är det 2an eller 4an? Vad heter det nu? Heter det version 2, men det heter 4.0, eller?
Ja, det där, jag kallar det fortfarande Entity Framework version 2, men jag tror att den kommer heta EF4 faktiskt, Entity Framework 4. De gör en major update där. Men det ser riktigt bra ut. Och det var coola verktyg faktiskt.
Jag har till och med gjort nu. Jag har ju snott Livsmedelsverkets data. Kanske man inte får säga. Men jag har ju, det finns att ladda ner. Så nu har jag
lånat med
stolthet. Och nu har jag dunkat in den i 2008. Och så tänkte jag köra Entity Framework på det. Och i en MVC-applikation.
Mm.
Och så. Det var en sak som jag märkte. Att MVC... projekten finns inte med i 2010.
Nej, och det gör de faktiskt inte. Jag kontrollerade förra veckan och fick reda på att de inte är incheckade just nu. De kommer göra en out of band release, kallar de det under tiden här nu. Och de kommer faktiskt att göra en del coola uppdateringar på MVC-ramverket närmsta tiden inför den slutliga releasen då, som kommer inom framtiden. Av 2010.NET Framework 4.0. Så de fortsätter utvecklingen på Codeplex egentligen just nu. Vilket är positivt naturligtvis. Och det går att checka in, använda MVC-delarna också i 2010.
Göra ett projekt i 2008 och sen öppnar den 2010?
Nej, man lägger in det. Jag har fått beskrivningar hur man ska göra. Jag tänkte att jag skulle kanske göra en liten webcast på det. Eller en beskrivning om hur man faktiskt kan få det att fungera. För jag tror att ganska många kommer intresserade av det. Det är ett bra tips faktiskt på vad vi kanske ska göra själva. Det första jag slog mig för när jag började titta på 2010 öppnade här i fredags, eller i lördags morse var det faktiskt, jag inställde den över natten. Det var att jag ville gärna veta var jag skulle börja. Nu börjar jag med Entity Framework, för jag var ju sugen på att veta det. Men det är ju en del nyheter i verktyget och i gränssnittet och sådana där saker. Och jag efterlyser lite där kanske också någon sorts guided tour över hur man... Vad är det man ska börja någonstans? Och det här kan vi också ta till oss. Nu vet vi inte om det kanske redan har annonserats när det här är publicerat. Då, eftersom vi inte själva har sett någon sådan.
Men jag tror inte att... Alltså, det kommer ett training kit.
Mm.
Och vi har sett en förhandsversion av det också. Som innehåller rätt mycket spännande presentationer. Men vad jag förstår så är inte det lanserat än. Utan det kommer ta lite tid.
Ja, det finns väl... Är det bara internt det kanske finns? Det har funnits en tidigare för PDC-en. Eller CTP-en också. Men det var ju också mest grejer för .NET 4. Jag tänker ju mer på de här delarna i Visual Studio. De nya debuggningsverktygen, hur man använder dem och testverktygen, arkitekturverktygen och sånt där.
Och då skulle jag rekommendera faktiskt att titta på Channel 9-videos. För att där har de ju ändå gjort ett antal presentationer så att man kan liksom följa med på sin dator nu och bygga och testa och så.
Tänker på 10-4.
Ja, 10-4.
Mm. De har ju nästan 20 nummer tror jag de har gjort.
Ja, någonting åt det hållet. Innan vi fortsätter och babbla på här i vår glädje över Visual Studio och .NET 4 så ska vi tala om att i slutet på den här podcasten så kommer vi också ha en intervju med Ron Jacobs. Och det är lite roligt, vi gjorde en intervju, jag, Johan och Robert för ett par veckor sedan på i en hotellfoyé i Kalmar när vi var och presenterade. Så det är en lite rolig intervju på många sätt där kan jag säga, men det var väldigt mycket bra information vi fick från Ron.
Absolut, Ron är ju en gammal senior i sammanhanget, har ju varit med väldigt länge också på mycket med arkitektur, han var ju arkitekt evangelist länge och nu fokuserar han ju på connected system då, alltså VCF och WF. Mycket VCF vet jag att det är just nu. Fast han, ja, vi kommer ju ta upp även VF också i intervjun.
Ja, och speciellt VF tycker jag att jag fick faktiskt ny insikt i vissa saker.
Sant. Jag lärde mig också en hel del saker när Ron berättade om det faktiskt. Så att det ska bli riktigt kul att prova. Sen kan jag tycka att det känns lite sårbart alltså när de faktiskt har skrivit om hela motorn i Windows Workload Foundation och får då visserligen en groteskt förbättrad prestanda, men det är spännande.
Men tillbaka till Visual Studio, den här intervjun kommer snart här borta, så vänta på den. Det som jag gjorde först egentligen, det var ju också, jag ville ju lära mig nu hur Visual Studio-gränssnittet. Mm. Så jag provade ju en sån här små hack, du vet det här att om vi till exempel ska hitta om vi ska gå till någon metod eller så har vi en ny search.
Just det.
Som är mer avancerad, så den kan söka dels på saker inuti ett ord. Så om jag till exempel har en label som heter LBL message, så kan jag bara skriva mess, så kommer jag till LBL message.
Just det.
Och ändå häftigare är det om vi säger att det är stort L på LBL message och stort M, då kan jag skriva LM med stora bokstaver, och då hittar den det också.
Mm-hmm. Den står för camel case.
Ja,
och
precis.
Vad häftigt. Ja, det visste jag faktiskt inte. Ja, de har tänkt till, alltså. Jag tycker de har gjort en del snygga grejer i gränssnittet. Det som jag också ser fram emot naturligtvis, det är att prova på extensibility-delen. Jag såg att du också hade börjat titta lite på de delarna. Det ska bli riktigt kul att se om vi får till det nu. Med MEF, eller Managed Extensibility Foundation. Vilket jag tror stenhårt på.
Och Johan, någonting som jag nu behöver då, som din anställd då?
Du kommer igen.
Ja. Det är att jag behöver flera monitorer.
Jag har flera skärmar.
Jag testar ju det också.
Jag tror det var mer minne.
Ja, det behöver jag också. Men alltså, jag bara drog, om man har den här tabraden högst upp, så drog jag en tab bara utanför ID:et. Och så vart det en helt nytt fönster. Och det ska ju då vara på en annan monitor naturligtvis.
Ja, det är samma sak. Du kan ju dra ut Solution Explorer exempelvis. Lägga den utanför.
Ja, men det måste vara på en annan fönster, en annan skärm.
För det ska hända någonting.
Ja, jättestor. 24 tums.
Ja, absolut. Nej, men vi lägger in det i budgeten här.
Har du sett de här bärbara som släpptes på CES som har två skärmar?
Ja, men inte en Dell. Alienware.
Nej, jag tror det var Lenovo eller
ja,
någonting.
Lenovo,
som man kunde vrida ut.
Ja, det såg jag.
En sån ska vi ha.
Ja, just. Den är inte ens, den är inte ens släpbar. Alltså, den är ju stationär bärbar.
Men den är en riktigt häftig dator, för den är gjord för fotografer.
Just det.
Så den har mycket bättre skärmar än vad vi har och sånt. Okay. Och vi har behov av
det. Alltså. En vikbar stationär dator kan
man säga. Ja,
nej, den var häftig faktiskt.
Sådana har vi inte. Men vad fick vi idag? Apropå det. Vi fick netbooks.
Ja, då köpte vi några netbooks faktiskt.
Ja.
Det här skulle bli roligt då. Jag vet att Danway sitter just nu och installera för fulla muggar här och håller på och gör så här USB-nycklar så vi kan syspreppa och installera lite trevligt och enkelt här. Vi behöver ju installera lite olika saker antagligen.
Ja,
och det blir kul.
HP, vad heter den?
2140. HP Mini 2140.
Mm, den var lite grå.
Den är inte lika röd som Vivien Tammen som jag hade förut då, som man alltså kunde ragga med. Men jag tror att den är helt okej. Okay. Riktigt trevligt tangentbord och skärmen är ju grym.
Mm, jag ska prova det för
att se. Det blir riktigt kul. Ja. Det är lite kul också den här med upplösningen är ju 1024x576. Men den har tydligen ut 1024x768 om man vill köra presentationer och sådär.
Resten, har den där VGA-utgång?
Ja.
Bra.
VGA, 2 USB. Vi säljer ju hårdvar här.
Ja, HP och Lenovo. Vi vill ha lite kickback på det här, eller hur? Ska vi försöka gå tillbaka lite till .NET 4 innan vi släpper in Ron?
Jag vill också faktiskt flagga lite för att vi släppte ju andra grejer här också den här veckan. I anslutning till betan av Visual Studio 2010 kommer vi att släppa, och det kanske jag går lite utanför händelserna här, men en ny CTP av Oslo SDK kommer jag komma också.
Lagom till 17 maj.
Ja, precis. Faktiskt. Det borde man kanske lanserat igår. Jag installerade också även det i helgen. Och där har vi faktiskt även äntligen stöd för Quadrant och installera lokalt. Så Quadrant, IntelliPad, kompilatorerna, repositoriet naturligtvis. Och det är också riktigt intressant att hålla på och leka med. Och jag ser ju bara mer och mer hur Oslo passar som handen i handsken i vår strategi framöver. Och märker ju flera och flera av våra tekniker också redan idag är designade för att passa in i Oslo. Exempelvis det som jag hade tänkt prata lite om idag, MSE. Managed Service Engine heter det, va?
Jag vet faktiskt inte vad du pratar om.
Ja, du ser det. Det är alltså en virtualiseringsteknik för tjänster. En virtualiseringsteknik för VCF-tjänster. Som gör att du kan alltså exponera virtuella endpoints till dina VCF-tjänster. Oavsett om de ligger i molnet eller lokalt. Och sedan exponera dem exempelvis via UDI och sånt där. Och den strukturen som de har valt i MSC då, som man kan ladda hem från serviceengine.codeplex.com. Allting till. Är ju då, strukturen är gjord ungefär ett repository som har lagrat sina endpoints, sina operationer, allting virtualiserat. Lite som Oslo fungerar liksom.
Oj, ja, nu är det ännu något mer.
Men har ni också kikat på.
Oslo, det tycker jag är det där. Var ska man börja där? Kan man ladda ner den här och finns det någon hjälp där? Eller hur kommer man igång? Jag har faktiskt inte kommit igång själv.
Först och främst tycker jag att det här nyhetsbrevet som skickar ut den här veckan med MSDN-nyhetsbrevet handlar ju om Oslo. Där jag och Alan Smith bland annat har skrivit en del om vad man kan komma igång med. Så tycker jag är jättebra att titta på. Och prenumerera inte på nyhetsbrevet så gör det såklart. Det är ju teknikfokuserat varje nummer nu. Och för att komma igång på Oslo så tycker jag msdn.com/Oslo är bästa sättet att börja på. Där finns det jättebra dokumentation, videos som beskriver koncepten, teknikerna, verktygen. Och där kan man också ladda hem då det senaste SDK och installera lokalt. Och försöka utvärdera lite om hur det här skulle passa i ens egen utvecklingsprocess egentligen då. Tanken är ju att det här ska integreras i utvecklingsverktyg eller passa åtminstone som handen i handsken i dem framöver. Exakt hur det kommer bli av och vilka verktyg vi kommer att se från det här vågar vi inte riktigt svara på idag. Men det här är några av de inkubationer som man har sett i alla fall. IntelliPad som står för IntelliSense WorkPad tror jag står för. Som är alltså en notepad med IntelliSense och validering, möjlighet att kunna olika grammatiker och hantera syntaxer och översättningar av olika dokumentformat och andra DSL och sånt. Och sen Quadrant då, som är en visuell modell, editor. Och det som är spännande med Quadrant är att Quadrant är byggt så som en Oslo-byggd applikation skulle kunna vara byggd. Quadrant har en VPF-loader, en runtime som laddar hela modellen för hur Quadrant ska se ut, agera, fungera ifrån repositoriet, vilket är en databas med konfigurationsinställningar egentligen. Komponenter och
Ligger kod där också? Då?
Nej, utan den anropar sedan då kod i bakändan i en assembly egentligen, som skulle kunna vara workflow-aktiviteter kanske som i ett SharePoint-fall exempelvis. Man skulle ju potentiellt kunna lägga även assemblies i databasen, men idag är det väl inte gjort på det sättet i alla fall då. Men hela beteendet och strukturen är byggt upp på så som vi tror att man kan bygga modelldrivna applikationer. Lite komposit-tänk och sådana saker. Så att utvärdera, ladda hem SDK, titta på några av de videos som finns som handlar om hur man bygger språk, hur man bygger grammatiker, hur man kan använda de här verktygen redan idag.
Innan vi släpper fram Ron då, så tänkte jag bara tala om också installationsupplevelsen av 2003. För ni kanske undrar, måste man nu avinstallera någon annan version och går det att avinstallera? För det första så går det helt enkelt, jag har inga problem att installera, har det via Visual Studio 2008 och 2010 samtidigt. Nu har jag inte kört jättemycket men jag kan starta båda.
Jag installerar faktiskt en annan grej i helgen också och det är en pre-release av Exynos Game Studio 3.1 här faktiskt, fick en intern release av i 2008. Så jag har även installerat grejer i 2008 efter att installera Visual Studio 2010 och det har fungerat hur bra som helst. Inga problem än så länge, verkligen. Och fortfarande, vi kan inte rekommendera att du installerar en beta på en produktionsdator utan du ska gärna installera en virtuell miljö eller helst en egen dator som du kan labba på.
Och vad jag förstår också så går det att avinstallera.
Det, ja, och det har vi inte testat.
Nej, vi har inte testat det, men den version vi hade innan nämligen, då var det no-no för avinstallation. Just det. Så det har gjort att vi har varit lite försiktiga med att, ja, att installera. Det man också kan säga att det finns inte MSDN library med, och det är ju egentligen positivt just nu.
Fast kommer det vara så på betan som släpps också, eller var det bara vår intern release?
Vi vet inte. Vi tror att, eller jag tror, inte på min är i alla fall. Nej, inte så. Okay. Och då blir vi av med 600 meg.
Något sånt, ja. Mm. Och sen så, jag installerar på en 64-bitars, fungerar det hur bra som helst.
Windows 32-bitars.
Windows 7 RC. Mm,
yep.
Ja, samma. Ja. Mm. Så att det fungerar både 64-bitars, både 32.
Det fungerar om man är vänsterhänt. För
ja,
och du...
ja, jag är högerhänt faktiskt. Ja.
Fungerar i Vallentuna?
Absolut.
Och i Farsta?
Ja, du ser. Ja, det fungerar överallt. Söderstan, Norrstan, det finns det inga aber alls.
Ja, vi ska väl, ni hör att vi är lite uppspelta idag, men det är så mycket positivt och vi känner oss väl lite som vi är barn i en leksaksaffär med extra priser.
Både hårdvara och mjukvara har slängts upp på skrivborden här, så att nu är det, vi kan inte sitta här längre, vi måste ju labba.
Ja. Så vi släpper fram Ron och vi pratar där om VCF och VF i .NET 4.0.
So I would like to welcome Ron Jacobs, who is with us in this podcast. Ron, please tell the audience, who are you?
Well, I am a technical evangelist, and I work out of Redmond here, where I'm closely integrated with the teams that produce WCF, Windows Communication Foundation, and WF, Windows Workflow Foundation. And I have been doing that for, I'd say the last year and a half or so. Prior to that, I used to be an architect evangelist. So many people are familiar with the podcast show I had at the time called ArcCast, and I spoke at a lot of events around the world. So, that's what I'm doing now.
You've been with Microsoft for several years now, haven't you?
Yeah, it'll be 10 years in November.
Wow. Okay, so looking into these technologies that you are focusing on now, like WCF and WF, so where are we standing today with Microsoft as with the technologies that we have? Do you have an update for us?
Sure. Now, one of the really fun things about this role as a technical evangelist is that I'm focused on the future. So I'm actually, and have been for some time, working with all of the new stuff, .NET 4, Visual Studio 2010, and, I love the future. I love it so much, I have everything future on my box here. I've got Windows 7, I've got Office 2010, I've got Visual Studio 2010. It's a wonder anything works. And in fact, very often I get crashes, and I was just working with the latest daily build of Visual Studio 2010, which turned out not to be so hot, so I had to go back to an earlier one. But that's the nature of things when you're working with the stuff that's on the bleeding edge. Sometimes there's more blood than productivity, So, but
I think that's isn't that the heart of being an evangelist at Microsoft?
Yeah, well, there are some people whose focus is more about the things that are shipping, or at least until there's, betas and such out. And the peculiar thing about my role is that I have to, the day when Visual Studio 2010 goes to beta 1, I have to have a whole lot of things ready to ship that day. And so that means I have to work with it in its pre-beta phase, which is very painful. But it is also very fun because it's a great opportunity for me to, know about things before anybody else does. So that's kind of where I'm at today. Now, when you ask the question, though, where do we stand kind of with WCF and Windows Workflow? I think there's a lot of challenges around these technologies. I mean, they're not trivial. They're not super easy to pick up and learn. In fact, one of the first things I did was I made a podcast for a show, my Endpoint TV show. I called it The Total Noob's Guide to WCF because, frankly, I found that a lot of people were really intimidated by WCF.
I read your blog post about ASMX and VCF. It's a really good ones that you did in the beginning when you changed your role.
Yeah. In fact, I found that, you know, while an ASMX web service is pretty easy to do, and almost everybody understands it, it's easy because there's not a lot of options. It's basic HTTP, and it's just really simple. And WCF is more complex because it has almost an infinite number of options, whether it's, you know, bindings or what kind of security you want to use, what sort of transport protocol. And it's infinitely flexible. It can do almost anything you want it to do. And so whenever you try to use it, you just have all these choices in front of you. And then when you decide what you want to do, because it's so flexible, the config can be difficult and, you know, that sort of thing. So, but we're happy with, overall, technically, I'm happy with where WCF ended up after its long journey. I was on the WCF team in its earliest days, and it ended up in a very nice place, but it's still too hard.
My comment to this is that I think too many customers and developers are considering WCF, for instance, as a new technology instead of ASMX, period. But WCF is so much more. And when you compare the ASMX features, like very simple to get started and it's happening behind the curtains, and compare that to the WCF, it's easy to understand that it's a bit overwhelming to actually grasp a hold of all these contracts and instances types and implementations and configurations like you mentioned. But when you also compare this like to remoting and socket communication, it's a very strong message or program model that we have created here.
Yes, it is. And so when we looked at what do we want to do in .NET 4 to make this easier, we hit on the idea of bringing workflow and a declarative model to web service development. And so I know for people who haven't done workflow, they thought that maybe workflow was sort of a thing where, like, SharePoint has workflow to kind of route and approve documents and things like that. But really, all the workflow is just a way to do a business process. And the process can be anything, really. And you author this process in a very declarative manner. So, you know, using activities that you drop on a design surface and just configure some properties and it's good to go. And I think where we're headed with this, and we're not going to get all the way in Visual Studio 2010, but we're making some very good starts, is to the point where, you know, using WCF and creating a service will be really a process of working with a design palette, dropping shapes, kind of configuring some properties. It will get a lot easier to create the kind of services you want to make and to do it in a way that's very simple and declarative. And then, of course, when you layer on top of that things like some of the cool work that the Oslo team has done with mGrammar, you could even potentially create a grammar that allows you to simply create a service out of a few lines of text if you wanted to. So when you say, well, how are we going to make this better? We're going to leave all the power of WCF. It will all be there. And if you're the kind of person that likes to use WCF at a very low level and access all of its power and configuration flexibility, you can do that. And then for the masses of people who say, gee, you know, I just want something simple. I just want to get this done, and it's got to be easy, and I don't want to become an expert on WCF to do it. Using a workflow service will be a way that you can do that as well.
So in the next version of .NET Framework version 4, we are going to marry VCF and VF more together then?
Yes, the way I like to say this was, you know, in .NET 3, WCF and workflow were strangers. They didn't even know each other. In .NET 3.5, they started dating. And in .NET 4, they got married.
One problem I think with VCF, and especially VF, is still the host, to host the workflows and such things. What are we doing there?
Yeah, and that, you're right, that has been an issue. And in fact, you know, we put a burden on people to kind of create their own host applications. And you can host them in IIS, and many people do. And so what we've got coming is yet another thing that's a project that's codenamed Dublin. And I've done some shows on about Dublin on my video podcast called Endpoint.tv. You can just go to http://endpoint.tv and you'll see where I've interviewed some of the team members and the architect about what Dublin is. But essentially what we've done is we've extended the hosting environment that IIS provides with richer management capabilities that really understand workflows and services, and it gives you a very nice, manageable production environment. You know, if you're the kind of person who likes BizTalk and you've been using BizTalk and are quite familiar with it, and then you move from BizTalk, which has a very nice management surface, and you move from that to kind of creating WCF services, there's a great lack of tooling in management and monitoring capability. So Dublin kind of wants to bring those capabilities to the world of WCF and Windows workflow services together.
So Dublin is not a BizTalk killer then?
It's an attempt to bring a lot of the capabilities that BizTalk has in terms of management to these sort of services. You know, BizTalk's a very interesting thing because some people see BizTalk as an integration server. You know, so it's got all these adapters and it knows how to talk to things like SAP and adapt those messages to something else, and it's a great integration server. And then some people looked at it and said, wow, you know, it has this orchestration capability and you can actually create business logic that runs in BizTalk. And so they looked at BizTalk as an application server. And many people have built applications that look at BizTalk as a back-end application server. And, you know, that's okay. I mean, if that's what you want to do, that's great. But a lot of people said, you know, gee, I don't want to learn BizTalk just to do a simple web service, you know, and they come to Microsoft and they say, hey, Microsoft, I want a back end where I can have web services and business logic happening. I want to write it in .NET and I want to, you know, do it the way I want, but I don't want to have to buy a big, heavy server product to do this like BizTalk. So this has been sort of a gap in the platform. So nobody wants to kill BizTalk here. What we want to do is provide a capability to do some of the same kind of things with a rich application platform and let BizTalk focus where it's really great on being an integration server and provide a way to do your application server stuff. Now, what you have to remember is that Dublin is not part of .NET 4. It's actually considered part of Windows Server 2008 R2. Okay, but it won't actually release at the same time they do. So a few months later, there'll be this download, a free download. You go download it on the web, you put it on your server, and you're good to go. Now, when .NET 4 releases, there'll be, you know, a nice release candidate version that you can work with and even put into production if you want to. But they just will need a little bit more time past the release date of .NET 4 to do their work and finish it up.
So if I understand it right, the Dublin will only run on Windows Server 2008 R2?
Yes, I believe that's the case. Yeah, I expect so.
Okay, so Ron, you mentioned earlier that you wanted to make WCF development easier for the developer. Was your work with the REST Starter Toolkit somewhat associated with that?
Yeah, that the REST environment has been very, very interesting. And, you know, when I first transitioned into this job, to be honest with you, I did not know much of anything about REST. And I met with the guy who was my predecessor, and, you know, he explained to me, well, you know, you need to do this. You need to teach people about conditional get, and you need to explain about content negotiation and all these terms. I had no idea what he was talking about, really. And so I went and got some books and read some blog posts and learned a lot. And over the past year have been speaking and writing about REST and then working with the team, the WCF team, to create a resource that would make it easier for people to do REST with WCF. Now, you know, you could do REST all the way back to when we released .NET 3.5, you could do it, but there was no documentation and no help, no samples, no anything. So the first time I tried to create my first RESTful service, it took me like 2 days to successfully do it. And I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm stupid or something, but it just, you know, it was way hard to figure out how to do this. So we set a goal that it ought to be possible for anybody to create a RESTful service, you know, in about 5 minutes and hit F5 and run it, and bam, it just works, you know. So you shouldn't have to go through a long, long process to do it. And that was a part of the work, the driving force behind the REST Starter Kit, which is something we created for Visual Studio 2008. It has, you know, templates and some class libraries and things. We put it up on CodePlex. It's a free download, and you can go get it and make a REST service pretty quickly. And I also created
really nice.
Yeah, and I also created some hands-on labs for the REST Starter Kit, and those are available on the MSDN Code Gallery. The easiest way to find all this stuff is just to go to the REST Developer Center on MSDN. So you go to msdn.microsoft.com/WCF/REST. And there you'll find links to the download, the hands-on labs, a whole bunch of videos we have on Endpoint TV, a lot of videos, some that I made, some that Aaron Sconard made from Pluralsight, that walk you through different things. So there's a ton of resources now, so nobody has any excuses. You can make a REST service, and it's real easy.
But Ron, I thought you was a soap guy before. How is have you switched all the way? Are you only talking REST now? Should we don't use soap anymore? Or
no, and you know what? And if you want, you can see the video of the talk that I gave at the Mix 2009 conference. I gave a talk there about REST. And one of the things I always say when I give this talk is that I don't see these as a war. You know, some people think of it like, oh, it was soap. Soap was the old thing. Now REST is the new cool thing. So we're going to get rid of soap. And I don't think that's the case at all. One of the things I appreciate about the chance that I had to serve as an architect evangelist, and in the work that I did with Arcast TV, I kind of talked to architects all over the world, is I got a great view of the perspective that architects have on things like this. See, a developer who doesn't understand the bigger picture just wants to get in a fight about it, you know, REST or soap. That is not the point. Each technology has a context, a set of requirements around it. And when you put it in the right context, it works great there. So if you're out on the web and you want people who have code that's running in JavaScript and browsers and mobile devices and all that kind of stuff, and you want them to be able to call your service, well, you know, the requirements are different. They want a lightweight HTTP only. They very often want JSON and not XML. In that kind of environment, REST is a great solution, and it really does very, very well there. SOAP will work, but it's not going to meet some of the needs, and certainly none of the big advantages that SOAP brings really apply in that environment, because very often you don't care about security, you're not using transactions, reliable messaging is not important, you know, those kind of things. But now, if you go back to the context where SOAP was born, which is really in the data center, inside the enterprise. You have to remember in, you know, 99 and 98, when SOAP was being conceived as an idea, the big problem 10 years ago, the big problem was, I've got a Microsoft box over here, and it talks DCOM, and I've got a Sun, can you believe that, Sun Oracle box over here. And those two can't talk together because the Sun box speaks RMI and the Microsoft box speaks DCOM. That was the big problem. And inside the data center, you have a different context. The context there needs security. It needs transactions. It needs reliable sessions. And so in that context, and the enterprise context also, the biggie, one of the biggies is WSDL. REST doesn't have WSDL. And, you know, if you think you're going to displace all the SOAP in your organization and switch everybody to WSDL, I mean, excuse me, switch them to REST, you're going to have people start screaming, hey, you know, when we use SOAP, we used to just right-click on my project, say add reference or add service reference, and it just generated this nice proxy for me. How do I do that with REST? And the answer is, you can't. So, you know, SOAP has a lot of advantages in its context that are still very valid and still the right thing to do. So I'm not one guy or the other. I'm not a SOAP guy. I'm not a REST guy. I'm just use the right tool for the right job. That's what I say.
But I personally think that we are actually ahead of the game here because we are constantly publishing or providing interfaces for all of our services, like on the Azure platform, both through SOAP and through REST. So I think we're really demonstrating that we are understanding both the tightness of the SOAP protocol and the features there, and also the big benefits of using REST-based protocols instead. So I think we are doing a good job for the developer community, and I think also think that our competitors are actually looking at our implementations and seeing how can we also provide these types of contracts or interfaces through our services. That is what we have noticed in doing events and discussing with other vendors of technologies as well, that they have not really come as far as we have done with this stack.
Yeah, and I think that the REST community, though, would say that there is more to REST than just this lightweight HTTP protocol. It's more of an idea. It's a design point of thinking that emphasizes resources, you know. It's sort of like that. I would say that a REST person says, I care about nouns. And a SOAP person would say, I care about verbs. I mean, right at the heart of SOAP is the SOAP action. It's a verb-oriented thing, like get customer, get order, submit this, or whatever. You know, it's about actions. And a REST person would say, no, There's a common set of actions. Those are the verbs that HTTP defines. And what we're really about is accessing resources. So I send an HTTP GET. It returns me a resource that's a customer. And if I want to submit a purchase order, I post to this endpoint. And, you know, honestly, you're doing the same things either way. But I think that REST people have a much stronger sense of this design emphasis. Of course, it depends on how restful they are, but that's another topic.
So will some of the features that you built in the REST Starter Toolkit be rolled into the .NET 4.0?
Yes, absolutely. And that was one of the goals of it. You know, it's been interesting to see the ASP.NET team sort of pioneered this with the MVC framework. And they went out and built MVC, and they put it on CodePlex, and they heard from a lot of people what they like and what they didn't like. And now they're putting that into .NET 4. So the REST starter kit was the same sort of process for WCF. We put it out there and we listened. We heard from a lot of people different things they liked or didn't like. We talked to some large websites who were looking at doing WCF for their REST implementation. And we got some very interesting feedback. Like, for example, one piece of feedback was the SVC file. You know, so in WCF, if you want to create a service that lives in IIS, you create this, you know, like customer.svc file. And it's like it has one line of text in it. And the one line of text is really configuration data. It says, you know, what the name of the service is, what the contract or, you know, stuff like that. What factory you're going to create. You can put code in the SVC file, but it's pretty rare that people do. It essentially is configuration that WCF uses to know what type to create and service the request. And the reasons for the SVC file, even the fact that it exists, are historic. It's just related to how we tied into the ASP.NET message processing pipeline and all of that. So we had this one large website who said, you know, we'd kind of like to do our REST service with WCF, but we think we're going to have maybe, you know, 500 REST services, and that means I got to have 500 of these stupid one-line files laying around on my web servers, and I got, you know, dozens of web servers. That's a lot of files. And you know, they look at every file on their website as sort of a management headache, you know, so they don't want to have more files than they need. And so they said, can we get rid of these stupid files? They're just configuration data. So we went back and we said, well, you know, nobody has thought about this since the early days of WCF. So we looked at it again and we said, you know what? It is possible for us to eliminate these files. And so in .NET 4, it will be possible for you to host a service without an SVC file. And you'll have entries in your web.config that provide a virtual path at point at, you know, the metadata, and we'll just load up the class and service it. So this was a case where, you know, that process, these people wouldn't have considered doing their REST service in WCF if it weren't for the REST starter kit. They liked what we did, but they asked for more. Now it's in .NET 4, and that's the kind of cycle we'd like to see.
Excellent.
How about Workflow Foundation then? What have you done in version 4.0 that are new? I knew that we have a new designer, for example. Could you explain more about this designer?
Yeah. So actually, everything in Workflow 4 is new. So this is one of those sort of rare and painful times when the team looked at Workflow 3.5. And they said, how do we improve this? There was a number of things they wanted to improve. They need to make the designer better. They needed to make it faster. They need to make it easier for people to develop custom activities. They needed to reduce its serialization footprint. It was a very large and ambitious list of things they wanted to do. So the team set about, started the architects, set around, you know, how can we do this? And they came up with a new runtime engine. Now, they could have, you say, well, can they fix the old runtime engine? And the answer is yes, they could have done that, but the changes would have been so dramatic they would break every workflow that's ever been written. So we have this kind of situation where some people created workflows in .NET 3 and 3.5. Not a lot, but some people did. And we want their workflows to continue to work. At the same time, we want to improve the workflow engine, and there's no way we can do both goals in the same engine. So we decided to take the existing workflow engine, the system.workflow namespace and all that. We're going to move it forward into .NET 4, so you will see the same classes, same designer, same everything has been moved forward into .NET 4. So if you wrote workflows in 3.0.3.5, they will continue to work just like they always did.
So no breaking changes then?
No breaking changes for them. And then there's a new workflow in .NET 4. It has a new runtime. It has a new namespace, system.activities. It has a new activity model, a new designer, and it meets the goals that we wanted it to meet. And so it's much more lightweight, it's much more integrated into doing things the way that everything else in .NET does things. Like, here's a small example. In the 3.5 workflow engine, if you wanted to control the threading model that the workflow used, like let's say you were running a workflow in an ASP.NET context. Workflow normally wants to spawn off a workflow on a different thread from the thread pool, which may or may not be okay, but in ASP.NET typically you did not want that. So you would have to create this object called a manual workflow thread scheduler, and you add it to the workflow runtime, and now you can control the thread. But in .NET 4, in the new workflow, we said, well, there's already a mechanism in .NET for coordinating threading and synchronization across technologies. It's called a synchronization context. So ASP.NET has a synchronization context. Windows Forms has one. WPF has one. So, why don't we just make our thing work with synchronization contexts so it's more consistent with the way that .NET does things? And that's just kind of one small example. I mean, the other thing that we did is we made it a lot easier to create activities in Workflow 4. It's really, really much, much simpler. There's not this complex model of queues that 3.5 had. There's a very, very simple model. And we just think that this is going to be a lot easier for people to author. And then on the runtime side, we solved some of the problems that people had around persistence. If you look at the performance problems that Workflow 3.5 has had, typically it's around persisting the workflow. Because when a workflow is running, it's got state, it's got all these properties, dependency properties that it had, and all these activities. In the Workflow 3.5 engine, has to take everything, all the state, all the activities, the whole thing, serialize it and stick it into a database. And if it's a large workflow, this could be a very significant performance hit. In Workflow 4, we made the runtime engine smarter about how much data really needs to be serialized. We introduced data flow rules, so every element of data in the Workflow 4 has context or lifetime and scoping rules. So we know when it's in scope or when it's out of scope. So it doesn't matter, even if it's a very large workflow, there's only a small amount of it that's in scope at any given time. So when we persist only what we have to. And that, along with other things in the runtime, we've seen performance improvements between 10 and 100 times faster for different scenarios that we run in our own performance tests. So, and of course, we made a better designer. The designer is now a WPF designer, and much faster. It scales better.
Could we still host the design ourselves also?
Oh, yeah. And see, this was the other thing. Many, many companies, many ISVs, wanted to create their own designer, right? Their own hosted designer. And the 3.5 designer, you could rehost it, but it was very complicated, very difficult. In Workflow 4, you can rehost a designer in about 3 lines of code. It is a WPF app, which means that you can do a lot of powerful things with it, like you can skin it so it has your look and your logos and things on it. So it's very, very easy to rehost the designer in .NET 4. The other thing we did was in .NET 4, we have made XAML a lot better. So in .NET 3.5, there was a XAML for workflow. They actually called it XOML, XAML. And there was a XAML for WPF. And though they looked similar, they were actually processed by different XAML stacks. So in .NET 4, there's one XAML. It's the same XAML for WPF and for workflow. And when you author a workflow, you author a XAML workflow. Now, You can compile it and put it into an assembly and all that kind of stuff. It's sort of, that's kind of the default experience when you create one. It's authored in XAML, but it gets compiled into classes in your assembly. But you don't have to do it that way. You can store the XAML out as a, just an XML file. You can put it in a database or whatever. You can load it and run it. It gives you a lot of unique advantages.
Nice.
So do you have anything to share on how this workflow engine is moving into Asia as well?
Moving to what?
Into Windows Asia, because we have a workflow engine in the services on the Asia services platform, and it's a small subset of what we have in the local version of the Workflow Foundation. But are we also considering even more features there?
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't recognize the way you said Azure.
Azure.
So,
yeah.
It's a very common discussion here in Sweden how we should say it.
So the workflow that is in Windows Azure is different. I actually have little to do with it. It is not the .NET 4 workflow. So the way that Azure is moving, it will be some time before they adopt .NET 4. So until then, they will have whatever workflow thing they have, and it's not the same as .NET 4 workflow. And then at some later point, they'll pick up .NET 4 in its entirety, and you know, then they'll enable workflows from .NET 4. But I don't know anything about schedule or when that will happen.
I still think it's a good thing for the Windows Workflow Foundation overall, because then we actually have a multiple set of runtimes. We do have the local runtime. We do have runtime in Dublin, but we also have the runtime actually in the cloud on Azure. So it's a good thing for workflow, and also possibly will increase the adoption of the technology, because it's easier to understand the features that you will get when running these instances of the workflows anywhere, possibly.
Yeah, I believe that it is eventually this will happen, and it's going to be a very good thing. One of the important things to remember about workflow is, because it's a declarative environment, declarative focuses on what you want to do, not necessarily how. And so you get less involved in, you know, what thread am I on, or what process is this a part of, or whatever. And so because it's declarative, it's more adaptable. So, you know, this is the same story of abstraction that, you know, we've passed through for years. You know, 10 years ago when I wrote C++ code, if I allocated a block of memory, I set exactly where I wanted it, and I, you know, could use it however I chose to use it, and it was mine until I freed it, and I was deeply involved in that block of memory. And then .NET came along, and I said, you know, it's easier for me to just say, hey, .NET, I would like an object, and I just don't really care where you put it, and just take care of that memory for me. I declared my intention, and .NET figured out what to do with it. And it took some getting used to, but eventually I felt that it was a far superior model. And I think this is the same kind of thing for business logic and workflows. When you author in this declarative environment, eventually you reach the point where you're more interested in declaring your intent and letting the runtime environment decide the best way to do it, whether it's on a single server in your organization or running in a fabric in the cloud. The hosting environment will just decide what the most appropriate way for it to meet the requirement that you've given it. And it gives us more flexibility in the long run.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And we see similar happening with the parallelism initiatives on parallel P-Link and other stuff in .NET 4. So I think it's a very good thing that we're moving in that direction.
Yes,
well,
so I had a question about the parallelism and the concurrency. Do the new Workflow Foundation runtime use this kind of stuff, so it can use several cores and so on?
So when it comes to parallelism in a workflow, this is a there's an interesting problem here. On the one hand, one of the goals of workflow is that we want to make it simple to construct a workflow, even to the point where maybe if you took a business user who's maybe a guy that can who loves Excel and he writes, you know, pretty complex spreadsheets with macros and things, you know. He's not a programmer, really, but he's a little more competent than your average person. And you give this person a workflow designer and a palette of shapes. He could create a business process and modify business rules and things that, you know, would be something that he could understand and maybe create. This is not the only kind of person who would create workflows. Certainly programmers would as well. But we'd like the workflow to be simple enough for that kind of person to do it. So, for example, one of the things we're doing is the expressions in workflow 4 are actually written in VB.NET syntax. So, you know, they're not case sensitive. If you want to and two conditions together, you use the word and not funky symbols and things like that. Well, so it's a little bit weird when you're writing your application and you're writing in C# and then you go to the expression editor and you have to remember, oh yeah, this is VB when you're writing the expression, but it takes a little getting used to, but you can understand why we chose to do that. Now, so here's the problem. Does this kind of guy understand the notion of parallelism and threads and deadlocks and race conditions? No. He doesn't understand it. Many of us programmers barely understand these potential problems, right? So workflows by nature partition your work. And that every workflow, the default behavior is that every workflow will be invoked on a thread from the thread pool. So if I'm running on, you know, one of these machines that we're going to have in a couple of years that has, you know, 100 cores on it or something, I have to think about the tasks of my application a little differently. Instead of thinking of them as in discrete steps that I do, I want to structure them into processes or, you know, business processes or workflows that I'm going to create. And I create these and I tell the workflow runtime, please execute that thing. And then it's going to go off and create it on different threads and all that sort of stuff. So if I'm executing, 100 different workflows, they're happening on, you know, many, many different threads and it will do the right things in terms of using the thread pool effectively and not creating too many threads and this saves me from having to deal with notions of race conditions and deadlocks inside of a workflow. Now, there is a case, though, where we want to be able to do asynchronous operations in a workflow. And this was an enormous problem in workflow 3.5. You just really couldn't do it. The reason is that in workflow 3.5, if you created an activity, let's say that it wanted to write some data to the database, but it wanted to use asynchronous I/O because async I/O is always better on server apps. And so your activity gets going, it does async I/O, it creates the callback, and then it completes the begin part of the write. Well, as far as the workflow engine is concerned, it thinks it's done. And the workflow engine might say, well, now that that's done, we can unload that workflow because it's done. But it's not done because the async write didn't complete. And there was no way to tell the workflow engine to not unload you from memory. So you really effectively could not do asynchronous I/O or any kind of async operations in workflow 3.5. But in workflow 4, we created a way where your activities can communicate to the runtime that they're doing something in an asynchronous fashion. And it creates what we call the no persist zone. So it effectively signals that though you're not technically busy, you're just waiting for I/O to complete, that this thing should not be persisted or unloaded from memory. the value of this is that any kind of activity that you want to have that does I/O can now safely do it asynchronously, which means that the guy who writes really good Excel spreadsheets can author some interesting business logic that maybe calls web services, updates databases, reads things from the file systems or from the web, and it does all the I/O asynchronously like a really good programmer would, but like this guy would never be able to write if you asked him to write it in C# or VB. So that's a very powerful feature.
Yeah.
It sounds really cool, actually. I didn't know that. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So I think we are closing into our deadline here. We have almost talked for 50 minutes, and it's been a really interesting session. Any final words, Ron? What do you think that what developers should turn to when they listen to this podcast and see, I want to learn more about the upcoming releases in .NET Framework 4.0?
Absolutely. Well, I can tell you what I've been doing for about the last month is I have been writing hands-on labs for .NET 4, WCF, and Windows Workflow. And I don't know about you, but the way I like to learn is by getting my hands on the technology and trying it out. And so we built some very interesting labs. They will get you using it. So when Beta 1 is released, which might be released by the time this podcast is published, depending on when, we will have hands-on labs for many, many different parts of .NET 4. There will be a Dev 10 training kit available for download on the web. I just wrote a lab this week that does one of the new features of WCF, which is service discovery. And in the lab, you have this little chat application, and you work through different phases where you enable your chat application to see other chat applications on the same subnet, and then you create a discovery proxy, and you can see other chat applications, and you know it's really, really fun to work with it. It's the kind of thing that you can do, you know, just across an hour or so of your time. Sit down at lunchtime and learn something new about .NET 4. It's a blast.
Thank you. I think what we should possibly close up here is something that I constantly say to all developers. That is, WCF and now also WFF is so central to our platform. It's so vital to developers to actually understand these technologies. But what we also are doing in .NET Framework 4.0 is actually decreasing the barrier, making it easier to actually adopt these technologies. And I think that's a very good thing. I really appreciate you taking time to talk to us, Ron. We wish you all the best in the future, both with the endpoint.tv and your new role as an evangelist. I'm really looking forward to talking to you again soon.
Excellent.
Thanks
very
Ron.
Much, guys.
Bye. See you later.
Thanks a lot, Ron.
Okay. Bye. Thanks. Bye.